Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Congo Square, Act 3. Le Vieux Carré had been a slum the likes that many believe deserved no less than sweeping demolition. But it is the French Quarter's very air of decay that has lured in romantics like me, like flies on shit. Renaissance des Vieux Carrés. Quite the headline, I know. Once a hack, always a hack. Regardless, I am not alone amongst the bohemians, artists, and writers who found it hard to resist watching the Creole women lowering baskets to the street for grocers to load with food, and just for the hell of it, an added pint of whiskey. The smells of the docks hang over the whole area, sickly sweet rotting bananas, and the more intimate smell of the dozens of bakeries that corner every block. It feels nice for a change, not to be the only romantic who gets a kick out of walking down the street with a French baguette under my arm. Again, just for the hell of it. By the end of the Civil War, most of the Crescent City had been gridded with streets, with Canal Street running right down the middle, separating the Anglos from the Creoles. The blacks, of course, were pushed back a town with all the outcasts. Pimps, players, hustlers, and ladies of the night. Which brings me full circle once again to Storyville. In Storyville, your race determined your positioning. White parlors were mansions serving as high-end brothels, while the lower-end brothels were reserved for the mixed races. The colored area, which consisted of rundown brothels known as cribs, was located near the cemetery. It was this area, in fact, that had attracted the servicemen who would get the district shut down, setting off the great exodus for blues musicians. And though a great wave is making its way north for Chicago, here I am, downriver, in New Orleans. Artists and writers are still arriving by the number, by the day, seeking out the same freewheeling urbanism, quaint surroundings, and the creative stimulus that is the crumbling Crescent City, I suppose. And seeing the hotels of the quarter had filled up, and I didn't get paid shit after the deal with Sam fell through, I found a low-rent flat in back of town. For 50 cents a day, I'm living off enormous bowls of homemade soup, boiled beef, and coffee from any of the cafes surrounding the hedges, where prostitutes now take their clients. Always a pint in reach, I write the nights away in my paradise of poverty. But never before cleaning the air with a nice long walk through the Garden District and up the quarter, cognizance well lubricated by the many sights and scents, to accents the antiquated gestures of my mind with a bit of zing. I am significantly taken aback by the old world architecture, and I stop in front of the old Absinthe House to tie my shoe, a beautiful, though humble, two-story structure with a wrought iron balcony on Bourbon Street, right in the heart of Le Vieux Carré. The old Absinthe House, constructed in the early 19th century, had operated first as a grocer, but keeping up with customer demand and thirst per se, the first floor was eventually converted into a bar by the 1840s, when Catalonian immigrants took over ownership. Quickly, the bar gained a bohemian following, though at the time, it hardly shone bright enough to stand out about the many blinding stars of New Orleans. Until 1869, that is, when the owners simply renamed the bar after the grandest star of all, a Swiss liqueur called Absinthe. And that changed everything, including New Orleans. Absinthe, la fille verte, or green fairy, a potent spirit derived from the flowers and leaves of Artemisia absinthium, more commonly known as Grand Wormwood. When mixed together with green anise, sweet fennel, and plenty of medicinal and toxic herbs, la fille verte as an inebriated Oscar Wilde once described, can produce phantom sensations the like of having tulips brush against the legs by Last Call. La Fille Verte makes you crazy and criminal, said to provoke epilepsy and tuberculosis, killing thousands across France. La Fille Verte, it makes one a ferocious beast of a man, a martyr of a woman, and a degenerate of an infant. La Fille Verte, it disorganizes and ruins the family and menaces the future of the country. And in 1905, a Swiss farmer murdered his whole family and attempted to kill himself after partaking only a few fingers of absinthe. La Fille Verte. Bohemians love it, and so do I. I check my dwindling cash purse, spin past a doorman distracted by a dame, head-to-toe and meek, and beeline it for the crowded bar, where in due time, a barkeep presents me with a dose of absinthe in a bulging glass, a cube of sugar on a spoon, and a carafe of ice water for $2 even. Damn expensive, but well worth it. And it is up to me, the patron, to prepare my own drink. So I mix it up, but instead of sipping on it, as is the proper thing to do, I simply throw it back, swallow down the dose of madness, and drop the sugar cube on my tongue. As the lights dim in the smoky room, the humdrum of the buzzing full house dulls, and the barkeep slides another wormwood before me, and I, another $2 before him. Not too bad, I suppose. I pay $3 in a joint just up the block. Again, it scalds my throat as I sweeten my tongue, as the applause settles, and I hear a velvet whisper. And I slowly spin around. Under the warm glow of stage lights, a beautiful singer stands on stage. She wears a shimmering emerald green dress that hugs her curves as she sways gracefully with each note. Fingered waves of hair frame her soft round face, rosy cheeks, deep red lips, a deep emotion hidden behind her closed eyes, gazing off somewhere within, but a raw emotion in a soulful voice that pours out of her heart, off her lips. Spilling a liquid dream, words drifting like smoke on ethereal hills, words like stardust in the night, painting shadows of love and loss, of undeniable pain, a spirit so wounded, so pure, so blue. And with a sudden beat and a breakdown, her eyes spring open with a burst of kaleidoscope light, big and brown and sparkling with the divine design that transports me to another world. In this woodworm trance, a tapestry woven where time transcends, the world falls away, and I'm lost in a magical delight. It's her. It must be. Trust your eyes, Oscar. I try, as my vision blurs in and out. Les Fées Vertes playing tricks on my mind. But it's her, right here, right there before me. I feel it must be. But don't be messing around, man, as the more certain I am. Don't do it, man. I rub my eyes and focus in on Little Bird. Oscar, I know you, man. Marco gonna mop the floor with your ass. As applause erupts, and she gracefully steps off stage, breathing heavily with emotion, entirely aglow. Oh shit, Oscar. As I take a step closer, and here we go, as phantom tulips brush against my legs, sidestepping through the adoring crowd, knowing there is no stopping me now. Side stage. Gold ring. Solid watch. Giant silk suit attempting to soften his towering presence, glamorize the scar across his face. Hey, Marco, I say. Marco grunts, looking me up and down, mostly down, and I quickly realize he does not remember me. I'm a journalist, I say, before I even know what I am saying. I'm doing a piece on the rise of Little Bird. Oh yeah, what paper? Asks Tony, stepping out of nowhere, as these guys tend to do. Cat has my tongue. You says you a journalist. What paper? He asks. The Canton Register, I say. Never heard of it, says Tony as Marco crinkles his brow. Little Bird just out of reach. Look, kid, says Tony. You gotta go through the proper channels. But he pauses, looks me over, and says, wait a minute. Do I know you? As he rolls back on his heels. Yeah, you one of Capone's boys. Wait, fellas, I say before Marco uppercuts me in the gut. I lunge forward, grasping for an impossible breath, and collapse to my knees. As I cough and wheeze, Little Bird notices the commotion, rushes over, giving Marco a firm look, shouting, "Let him go! Stop it! What in the hell are you doing?" Marco hesitates, wanting to munch on my bones, devour me entirely. "Back off," says Little Bird. "Back off," she insists. Me, trying to lighten the mood. "Just a little starstruck is all. I'm alright. As Little Bird tends to me with worried eyes. "I am so sorry about that. Marco can be a bit overprotective." Me, smiling, trying to brush it off. It's alright, I get it. Little Bird helping me to my feet. "That's not how I want my fans to be treated." 5 minutes till set, Little Bird, says Tony, with a long, suspicious glare, as Tony widens his eyes and she back at him. She waves him off angrily and pulls me just backstage. "It really is okay," I say. "Just a little excitement is all." Little Bird grins, saying, "Excitement is one way to put it, but really, I appreciate you coming up to me. It means a lot." "Well, your music means a lot to me," I say. "It's like you're singing my own heart out there." As our eyes lock, my stomach swirls with delight. "That's the magic of blues, I suppose," she says. "We all carry our own stories, and I'd love to hear more of yours," I say. "Maybe with a little less excitement," I say, looking over my shoulder at Marco, who watches from the corner of his eye. Little Bird smirks. "Definitely less Marco," trailing off. "If you want to make it up to me, you can grab a drink with me sometime," I say. "I do owe you," she says with a sigh. She looks stressed. My mind bounces around like a pinball trying to save the moment. "No promises, but I'll do my best," she says, the sound of laughter erupting as a comedian of sorts entertains the crowd between sets. She looks lost. "Are you okay?" I ask, as her eyes well. "Huh? Oh, yeah, sorry," she says, shaking something off her mind. Suddenly I see the back of my own hand running down her cheek. She smiles and sniffles, attempting to dry her eyes with a finger without smearing her mascara. I search my pocket for a handkerchief. It's okay, she says. "Now you're the one who's okay," I say. "Now I owe you a drink," I say. "You're funny. I'm sorry, what's your name?" She asks. Oscar Clyde Olson," I say, holding out my hand. "Well, it's a pleasure, Oscar Clyde Olson," she says. "I'm Neve." "Heaven," I say, as the crowd audibly grows louder. "How did you know that?" "Words are kind of my thing," I say. "I see. Well, your thing is working, Oscar." She blushes with a giggle. "You've got a voice that could stop time, you know," I say. 30 seconds, shouts Tony. But upon seeing Little Bird's wide angry eyes, he disappears. "Well, that's quite the compliment, Oscar," she says. "Honestly," I say, "it's heart-wrenching." And Little Bird playfully, "Is that a good thing? You know, I'm just trying to tell my stories." "It's more than that, Neve," I say. And she seems taken back by hearing her own name. "It's like you're pulling me into your soul," I say. "Like I feel you. Like I know you." "That's sweet, Oscar," she says. "I've never felt trying to sound as sincere as I am."
Shh.
She places a finger on my lips. "You'll make me cry again." And she leans in slightly, our eyes locked, an electric moment passing between us, our gaze softening, hearts quickening.
"Time," shouts Tony from out of sight.
And she quickly steps back, looks down at her dress, preparing to go out on stage. "How are my eyes?" she asks.
"Beautiful,"
I say. "No, really," she says, dabbing her cheeks with a brush.
"Perfect,"
I say. "Listen, Oscar, I sing here every Thursday night as the music begins again." "Neve, wait," I say. "Meet me after the show."
"What?"
she asks, taken back.
"Seriously,"
I say. Marco grunts.
"Damn, I'm coming,"
she snaps. I stare deeply into her eyes with a puppy dog hope in my own. "Look," she says in a rush, "where are you staying, the quarter?"
"Back of town,"
I say. She pauses to look up at me with an odd glare. "Off Saratoga, above the Anderson, do you know it?"
"Yeah, Storyville,"
she says, with a gentle shake of her head and a grin.
"Rent's cheap,"
I say as she begins to slip away. "Neve," I stop her again to dab a smear of mascara from her cheekbone.
"Good to go,"
I say. And she looks deep into my eye with a wince. And after a beat, quarter after three, she says into my ear, "I'll yell up from the street." And she walks back out on stage.
Damn, what can I say? I bite my fist as the club erupts. I shake my fist.
"Oscar,"
and take a deep breath, straighten myself out. exhale into my pressed palms, and step out passing Marco as quick as I might. Little Bird stands at her microphone amongst a slow, haunted melody.
Thank you, everyone. You're too kind. This next one is for anyone who's ever loved and lost.
And her eyes close to the single spotlight shining down upon her. Lips nearly touching the mic, she interlocks her fingers around it, grasping tight. And after a beat, with a single word,
blue,
she pours out her soul. Back in the crowd, I lean against the bar, and I raise a finger for a simple beer. The guy next to me looks over, saying, "Damn, man, how you be knowing Little Bird?" And I smirk. ...3 a.m. Back on my terrace, I take a look down the street, but not even a stumbling drunkard can be seen in the rain. I down my bourbon and step inside to pour another. It's humid, and I've unbuttoned a second sweat-soaked shirt. My chest heaves with each breath. I am nervous, hoping the bourbon takes hold, and I cannot quite recall how many times I've refilled my glass. Yet after buttoning up my last clean shirt, I refill it again. 3:15 a.m. Hooves echo near and distant again, and I hear a holler from the street. My stomach twists as I spring back out on the terrace. All tied up in knots, I shout, "Hey!" at a hand waving out from under a coat in the rain. I gather the pages of my manuscript into a pile and shove them in a drawer before kicking a few loose sheets under the bed. "Here, let me take your coat," I say. Sopping wet, she moves further into the room, the warmth of the space enveloping her. I watch, heart racing, as she scans the room. "Sorry, the place is kind of a mess," I say, a hint of nervousness in my voice, kicking one last sheet under the bed. "It's charming," she says. "It suits you," before stepping toward the terrace. "Look at that view," she says, gazing out the French doors. "Wow, it's really raining," I say, taking a moment to skim the abandoned burrow with my own eyes and the soaked ruin beyond. "I can't believe I'm here," she says. "Can I get you a drink?" I ask. "No thanks," she says, and I awkwardly set down my glass. "A towel?" I ask all nerves, and she can see it as she steps toward me, the soaked fabric of her dress dripping with every step, the oil lamp flickering in the thick air. She steps closer, her gaze intense, searching my eyes, biting her lip, before her voice drops to a whisper. "Oscar," she says, reaching out to slowly brush her finger against my arm, the touch sending a jolt of electricity through me, heart racing. "Can I be honest?" she asks, staring intensely into me, air crackling. I lean in slightly, my voice low. "Of course." While closing the distance, she says, "I see you and all of your pain." I reach out, brushing a strand of hair behind her ear, our faces just inches apart. And with a sudden spark of courage, I seize the back of her head with my hand, pulling her into a deep, long kiss. Hearts beat into one another until she suddenly pulls away, but only an inch. As we both breathe heavily, her lip quivers as our eyes interlock, studying the right, studying the left, a shared look of longing as we slowly lean in, meeting softly again. A gentle exploration that gradually deepens, becomes more urgent, filled with the pining that has been building between us. My hands find their way to her waist, pulling her closer as Neve wraps her arms around my neck. But I pull back slightly, saying, "I don't want this night to end." "Don't stop," says Neve, breathless, eyes dark with desire. "We don't have much time." The passion ignites and we lose ourselves again, pulse erratic as we stumble for the bedsteed. The bedsteed, battered wood that creaks and moans at every move upon its well-matted mattress, crying out for mercy, rejoicing hallelujah, bringing soundless Storyville back to life, if even for a time. Act 4. 4:12 a.m. My head bobs in her belly with each breath before she slides out from under me. Nevaeh appears tense in her eye. Her brow is crinkled. She takes a cigarette from her handbag and walks onto the terrace. I roll to my back, the sweat glistening on my forehead. I kick the sheets from the bed, sit up and stand, and join her as she leans on the railing, exhaling in the nude. "So, the mystery room," I say. "What?" she asks, taken aback. I raise my eyebrows. "What do you know about the joint?" she asks, looking me up and down with a grin. She moans. "You a Chicago boy, ain't you?" "I saw you perform back before Christmas," I say. "I see. It all makes sense now," she says, raising eyebrows of her own. "What?" I ask with a grin of my own. "It's rude answering a question with a question, Oscar," she says. "What do I know about the joint?" Taking a drag, looking out over Storyville. "Okay, well, to answer your question, I was running barrels for Capone." "You what?" she asks, stepping back in shock. "You are serious. Why are you messing around with Capone?" she asks. "You trying to get yourself killed?" "Now it really does make sense," she says in a rather harsh tone. "I saw you down at the docks in the back of Silver Dollar Sam's Silver Fox," I say. "It's a silver ghost," she says, in a beat of silence. She shakes her head from side to side, exhaling with frustration, and asks, "So you a gangster?" No, I'm a writer. A starving writer, if you want to know the truth. And I was just trying to make some ends meet. Look," I say, walking inside. I'm writing a book, opening the drawer to my manuscript. I plop the stack of pages down on the desk. "You writing a book about being a gangster?" "It's about my life, I suppose." "That's what I'm saying, Oscar. You're too smart to be messing with them people. So why on earth are you messing with Capone to write a book?" "I was running barrels so I could afford to write my book," I say. "Why ain't you got a normal day job? I don't know, like normal people." "Like you?" I ask. "Anyways, I had a regular job, but..." "But what?" she asks. "It was killing me." "Oh, and Capone ain't gonna kill you? Or better yet, you don't think Sam will kill you? You and me? When he..." She trails off in frustration. "When he what?" I ask. She drops her head, mumbling to herself. "What am I doing here?" She takes a drag, exhales into the night, and tosses her cigarette to the street below. Sparks dash in the slight breeze as her nude body breaks out in goose pimples. "Here," I say, running to grab the sheet from the floor. She wraps up, walks inside, cursing under her breath. I pour myself a drink and down it in one swallow. Nevaeh takes notice but says nothing. I refill the glass and offer it to her. "No," she says, settling on the edge of the bed. I sit beside her. "Look," I say, "it's not what you think. I am real." "Real what?" she asks. "I'll tell you what's real. I'm a real idiot for falling for this." I sigh, saying, "Everything I've said to you is the truth. The honest truth. I'm an honest man." "It's not about those words you used to get me here, Oscar," she says. "It's the words you left out. Those words you knew would have kept me away from here. Here and you." And she is right. A long beat of silence. "Well, you found me," she says. "I did," I say. "Really, Oscar? You came all the way down here looking for me?" "No," I say. "I ran barrels downriver, and when I saw you at the port, then I stayed because of you." She looks quickly over at me, and for a moment, our eyes catch. "Why?" she says. "Who do you think I am?" "'Cause I guarantee you, whatever's going on in that crazy head of yours, it ain't true, and it ain't right. And now it's gonna get us both killed." "Shh, don't say that," I say. "What, the truth?" she asks. "For a writer, you sure scared of the truth." She stands and walks back to the terrace. And after a beat, I follow. A faint drumming catches the wind and echoes through the abandoned burrow. I lean against the doorway, halfway in, halfway out. The story of my life. "You know the story of Storyville?" she asks. "A bit," I say, as I walk up behind her and grasp the railing on each side of her. She is now calm, and I rest my chin on her shoulder as we both look out over Storyville. "Why are you living in back of town anyhow?" she asks, looking down at a lone, scantily clad woman making her way down the street, nearly too drunk to remain upright on her heels. Nevaeh strikes a match on the wrought iron, and it illuminates her face. Her brow is crinkled, but in a steady gaze of concentration. Besides the occasional draft of drumming, Storyville is quiet and empty. and the cherry on her cigarette lights up the night. I can see clearly that the past runs through her veins, haunting not only the lyrics of her songs, but that of her soul. I know sad stories ring aloud in her ear. Neve, I say, wanting to say, I can see you and all of your pain. But instead I ask, tell me about Storyville. What do you want to know? She asks, anything. I say, she takes a breath. Look at it. First they shove you in a corner, and then they come in and clean you out just because some white man woke up on the wrong side of the bed. She clenches the wrought iron in a fist, saying, Daddy met Mom in Storyville. Though it is clear by her pain, it is not a story she wishes to relish in. So I say, offering to lighten the mood, You sounded great tonight. Thank you, Oscar, she says. And I guess it did take guts to walk up to Marco like that, looking back at me over her shoulder. I kiss her on the forehead and run a hand down the full curve of her hip. Gently, I grasp her hand and slowly pull her back inside. She drops the sheet to the floor, and we fall to the pitiful raw mattress once again. She rolls on top of me, and we kiss passionately for a song. A.M. Neve rolls off of me, hot, sweaty, and out of breath, chest heaving for what air is left in the room. I stare up at the ceiling, warped with waves of humidity. So how do you like New Orleans? She asks. Love it, I say, a trotting, echoing below. Neve turns to her side and runs her fingers across my belly with a slight moan. And after a slight moan of my own, you know, I say, the liquor capital of America, the decaying monument, rich as jambalaya and gumbo, opening its arms wide to a dry nation, Renaissance de vous carré, the paradise of poverty. She gives into a slight laughter. My, oh my, she says. You sure know how to abuse them words. She laughs a bit harder, a beat of calm. Neve, I ask, why do they call you little bird? An elongated silence persists. It's okay, I begin to say. There's this old story Daddy used to tell me at night, trying to put me to sleep, I suppose. She says, about a slave. Anyhow, says one night the slave was feeling low in spirit, but then he heard the cry of a nightbird. The sound inspired him so to go get a piece of cane the next morning, and he cut some holes in it. And that bird had taught him night after night to sing that reed. Daddy used to blow in a bottle, whatever bottle he was sipping on at the time. See, he didn't have no panpipe. But with that bottle, he taught me the song of the nightbird. He'd say, now there you go, little bird, you got it. Neve sits up, stands, and circles the room, running her fingertips upon the surface of the desk, the dresser, the sink, the wall, in the void where the French doors open to a fresh breeze, and along the wallpaper peeling from the damp walls, singing softly, oh, that bird and that egg in that nest on the branch on the leaf. Now in that egg there was a little bird, the prettiest little bird that I ever did see. Oh, the bird and the egg in the nest, and the nest on the branch on the limb, and the tree in the hole in the ground. Green grass growing all around and around. Oh, the green grass growing all around. I sit up, grab my glass, and fill it with a shaky hand. I down it and refill it again. She stops at the bed, looks down at me, and says, and then Daddy drank himself to death. Boom. A dead silence. And after 120 beats, what time is it? Shit, I gotta go. Gathering her dress from the floor. Let me walk you, I say, jumping to throw on my trousers, tripping and falling to the floor. For heaven's sake, Oscar, lay down, she says. I ain't drunk, I say, just clumsy. I'm gonna walk you. It's the gentleman thing to do. No, you cannot walk me, she says. We can't be seen together, Oscar. Look, the old absinthe house on Thursdays. Come drink your ass off. Listen to me sing. But don't. Do not approach me again. You hear me? And she pulls her dress over her head and straightens her hair in the mirror. And drink some water, she says, reapplying her lipstick. I don't know what to say, so I say, Neve, leave with me, before I even know what I've said. 4:52 a.m. What? What are you talking about? She asks, just as surprised as I am. Leave with me tonight, I say. Oscar, you're acting a fool. Besides, where would we go anyhow? Sam would find us and kill us no matter where we go. Fuck Sam, I say. Fuck Capone, fuck Sam, fuck Marco, fuck the world. Just me and you, you and me. She stops in her tracks with a 1,000-yard stare into the mirror. And after a beat, breaks out of her trance, saying, Oscar, what do you want from me? I just don't want to lose you. And again, she grows still and quiet. But she suddenly rambles on. What kind of life are we going to live anyhow? You ain't got no money. As I drop my head into my hands. We gonna live off bootlegging? Your book? Shit. She bites her tongue and sighs. And drops her head. Dropping her back into the wall. Oh, I'm sorry, Oscar. I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean that. It's okay, I say. Harsh, but an honest assessment of my writing, I suppose. No. Hey, it's okay, I say. Cupping her chin. Neve, look. She is stubborn, but gradually looks up to see a smile wide across my face. What? She says. Look, look, I say. Do you see how happy you make me? I have never, never felt this happy, I say. You really is crazy, she says, planting a kiss on my lips. And this truly is amazing. You are amazing. But I need stability. And besides, I leave with you, and we're both dead by the parish line. Neve, no one will even know we're gone until morning, I say. It's already morning, Oscar. That's why I gotta go. We can hitch a ride right out of here, straight for the Pacific. I say she pulls on her shoes. Look, Neve, I say, I love you. She pauses, turns toward me and says, you really are a crazy white boy, you know it? She steps forward and plants her lips onto mine. I lean her back romantically and she lets out a laugh, head and arms dangling back toward the floor. I flip her up and she stares dizzily into my eyes. A warmth spreads across her face. A gentleness in her gaze. What do you think? I ask. I think, she says softly, and with the loveliest grin, I want to see you again.
Woohoo!
I cry out. Thump, thump, thump. Thump, thump, thump. 5:01 a.m. Shit, says Neve, staring at the door. A long, long beat. Smash! The door flies open. Marco, standing 6'10" in the hall. Shit, I say as Marco throws a titan of a fist right for my face, landing a solid punch to my jaw. Neve screams. The impact reverberates through my skull, and for a brief moment, everything goes silent. In an instant, time freezes over. I feel a wave of dizziness wash over me, as if the floor beneath me has suddenly tilted. My vision blurs, and Neve's beautiful yet horrified face fades into a haze. The force of Marco's punch has sent my brain rattling against the inside of my skull, triggering a cascade of neurological responses. In mere seconds, which feel like an eternity, my mind drifts, caught somewhere between life and death, as my body, acting on instinct, has decided it is safer to shut down. To shield itself from any further harm inflicted by this monster of a man. Stumbling backward, my arms flail, and I can't find my footing. The world around me spins, as I sense a strange detachment from reality. But I have been here before, watching myself from a distance. 5:02 a.m. Now comes the darkness, enveloping me like a thick fog. Pulling me down into a void where sound, light, and sensation cease to exist. In this state, I am oblivious to Neve's screams of horror as Marco grasps onto her and throws her into the mirror, shards shattering about her on the floor. Her frantic shouts for help are useless as he calls her a whore, as any concerned expressions on the faces about the abandoned burrow are non-existent. The Swamp. In fiction, it is often portrayed as a godforsaken place that no man enters willingly. It is infested with tribes of hideous frogmen, creatures who slink from their half-sunken temples, grasp the unwary with their cold hands, and drag them beneath the still black water. At the very least, the swamp is the home of poisonous snakes, strange and curable diseases, ancient curses, witches, and hoodoo priests. Of course, there is an element of truth in all fiction. The swamp does attract insects and oversized mosquitoes, and the sodden terrain can make traversing on foot impossible. Lost in a heavy blanket of fog and darkness, inhabited by alligators, crocodiles, piranhas, leeches, and god-awful humidity. As I begin to surface from the depths of my own darkness, I feel the coldness of the watery muck beneath me. Gradually, the sounds of the swamp start to filter into my awareness. The soft breeze of rustling reeds, a chorus of peeps, ribbits and croaks of bullfrogs, the call of a heron, a quack echoing through the trees, leaves and branches rustling, a deafening buzz of insects feeding on my flesh, lapping water, and a sudden splash, countless noises real and imagined. Blinking against the harsh light, I begin to piece together what has happened, but a confusion washes over me. My head throbs as I struggle to realize not only where I am, but how I got here, while grappling with the remnants of my disorientation. I take a deep breath of pungent air. The reality of what has occurred begins to settle in, as with each passing moment, clarity returns. Neve, I say in the dim light of the swamp. I feel the roughness of rope biting into my wrists. Glancing around, heart pounding in my chest, I see I've been tied to the tree that digs into my back as I pant air that is thick with the faint smell of death. I can't afford to panic. I need to think clearly. Struggling against the rope, I suddenly remember a trick I had read about in a book. It is risky, but I have no other choice. Taking a deep breath, I relax my muscles, letting the tension drain away. The ropes are tight and my arms are nearly numb. But if I can just maneuver my hands, I might be able to slip free. With my wrists pressed together, I begin twisting one hand and the other, trying to create some slack in the ropes. And before I know it, what feels like an hour has passed as I slowly work the knots, feeling the fibers shift against my chafing skin. Hearing more splashing louder and nearer, but I stay focused on the sensation, concentrating on the pressure points where the ropes dig in. After several more attempts of carefully twisting, I feel a glimmer of hope. The ropes begin to loosen slightly. I take advantage of the newfound wiggle room, moving my hands closer together and angling them toward my back. With each subtle movement, I'm inching closer to escape. But suddenly, I hear voices and footsteps echoing from somewhere nearby, and I feel I've only got moments before I am a dead man. A sudden void forms in my chest as my heart drops and adrenaline surges through my veins. I force myself to stay calm, but I have to act quickly. With a final twist and a pull, the rope slips away, and I manage to work one wrist free. Heart racing, I quickly move to free my other hand, and just as I wrestle it out of the last of the binding, the footsteps and rustling, the voices grow louder. I can see the blurred shadow of figures through the trees. Time is running out. With my hands free, I take a moment to gather myself. I scan the swamp for anything I can use as a weapon, and my eyes land on a thick branch on the ground nearby. I grab it just as the figures come nearly into view, and I lean behind a tree, raise the branch like a bat, and it crumbles to a dry rot mess.
Boss!
Tony shouts.
He got loose!
Reaching for his gun. Without hesitation, I run, 100-proof epinephrine fueling my every move, shouting and gunshots ringing out, bullets striking tree trunks and whizzing past my head. I dash deeper into the swamp, throwing one foot before the other like a mad, chaotic, clumsy, yet frantic, desperation-filled lunatic, propelling forth in a breath-gasping flash. With each racing beat of my heart, Tony pulls his trigger, releasing a fire pin under spring tension. Sergeant White had taught me that the firing pin strikes the primer, sensitive to impact, creating a small explosion as it strikes. Igniting the gunpowder within the cartridge, a rapidly burning chemical mixture produces a large volume of gas, hot and quickly expanding at high pressure within the cartridge chamber, pushing the bullet forward into the barrel of the gun. And as the bullet travels down the barrel, it encounters resistance, rifling, and spiral grooves, imparting it to spin, stabilizing its flight as it accelerates directly for the back of my head, a kinetic energy that intends to kill me with velocity, penetrating, deforming, and fragmenting within my brain. Tony experiences a recoil, a backward movement of the firearm in his hand, due to Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The recoil affects the accuracy of his shot, which whizzes past my head, mere inches from making me alligator food. The thoughts that race through my mind at the most opportune time never cease to amaze me. Unsure of which direction to go, I continue sloshing forth. As the muck sucks at my feet, the swamp is hungry. And as the shouting and gunshots fade, I begin to worry about snakes and alligators. As I effort forward, I do all I might to avoid examining any processus reptilian digestionema. I see a clearing ahead and escape the grasp of the swamp, and I feel a dry dirt road beneath my soggy palms. Looking up at the break in the trees, the morning sun nearly blinds me. I stand and begin limping down the narrow road, as baby birds cry out in hunger, their mothers searching about the lush greenery for worms. I keep a frantic look over my shoulder, expecting the silver ghost at any moment to come cruising around a bend. When I hear a slight echo, I run off the roadside, ducking in tall grass. Wait, are those hooves? Yes, those are hooves. And I spot two men in a wagon, and as they near, I stand, staggering out into the road, arms waving, myself in a wretched, panicked mess.
Coyon!
The driver shouts in Cajun French as he pulls on the reins, bringing the wagon to a halt. As I attempt to stutter out the entirety of my circumstance, words fail me. The Creole men look back down the road in a fear of their own, motioning for me to hop in the back of the wagon and bury myself under the heaping sacks of live crawfish. Luce pia la pia tu, says the driver, and we trot away. Arriving at the French market, I hop out of the back of the wagon, looking like any other drunkard who had woken up on the bank of the river, and hardly anyone appears to notice the condition of my appearance. All but a newsboy, who takes a good look with a jaw-dropped gawk as I make my way through back of town. All is quiet as I creep down the block. I intend to be careful not to alert anyone with the creaking floorboards under my feet as I climb the stairs of the abandoned Anderson. This proves impossible, so I exit, circling the building to climb up the terrace. The French doors are open, and as I peek in, the room is empty, all but the furniture flung about and knocked on their side. Still, I am careful to step across the room upon shards of shattered mirror. I open the door slowly and peek out and down the hall. Nothing. I close and lock the door. I pull the mattress back on the bed and plop down, dropping my face in my hands. Opening my eyes, I see my face in a shard on the floor. I look bad. I look terrible. The whole left side of my face is swollen. And with a good whiff, I smell like swamp and shit. I remove my shirt, fill the basin with water, and wash my face in pits. I find a bottle of scotch lying under the desk, unscrew the lid, and walk out to the terrace. No. I realize that's a bad idea. I walk back in, shut and lock the French doors. It is hot, and my fresh face quickly collects with sweat. I plop down, take a swig, pour a bit of whiskey on my wrists, let out too loud a moan, and nearly shatter my teeth. I'm exhausted and fall back on my back, and it cracks. Ah, fuck, it hurts. Everything hurts. My back spasms, taking my breath away. I grab the pillow and smash it into my swollen face. I take two deep breaths and catch her scent. Its pleasantness hits hard. Another big whiff, and I melt into her. I melt into the mattress, still damp with our sweat. Neve. I sit back up with sudden concern. I set the bottle on the floor and slowly look around. I catch her scent once more, the sweetness provoked by the heat of the room. I stand and begin to look about the room, empty and small. I pause, the scent growing stronger. I take a seat on a trunk, resting my weight on my hands. and I feel a satin fabric under my fingers, and I look down to see a bit of vibrant green closed in the lid of the trunk. I stand. I slowly open the trunk, and I peer within. I stare, face emotionless and cold, drained of its blood. Eyes widened. Tears welled in my eyes. Tears rolling down my cheek, dropping, splattering on her nude thigh. Her head at an unnatural angle, arm twisted beneath. She lies in a nest of her gown. No, 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 I say, caressing her face. Swollen, bloody, and purple. An unrecognizable pulp. Breathtaking beauty, now a horrid mask of demise. The fresh sin of death rises as hell rains down upon me. I drop to my knees, trying to pull her from the trunk as it tips, and with her stiff body, I fall to my side. Running her hair behind her ear, I sob. As off and beyond, a soul trumpet screams. The paddles of the steamboat slap the muddy waters upstream in a mixture of hope and grief for those second-class passengers aboard. For many, the Delta home is left in the wake of an almighty fight against the current, making way for the headwaters of the north. In the spirit of the frail, beaten, and weary traveler, ambition and inspiration is carried in the hearts of cradled children, as all are children of God, even as the seasons turn again and again, spoiling the milk that spoils the soul. Life has a way of turning man like butter, solidifying in the eyes of society who one is and who they are likely to become. And in time, the skillet that is time, hot as the rising star, bleeds one's fate down streams unforeseeable from the onset toward a sharp truth. A wound, a delta all one's own, somewhere beyond the reach of mercy. For every destiny comes to lie bare on the bank of a mighty river, wholly exposed at dawn in the midst of sunshine, stuck in the old Mississippi mud, sleeping ever soundly next to an old clay jug through the steamboat's mighty whistle blow. I toss my thoughts, never so desperate for an escape, into the current, drop my chin to my chest, clench my eyes shut, and try to grind through my hurt. My diaphragm spasms, but I do all I might to hold back tears, with plenty of thieves lurking about. I've sat upon my suitcase at the forwardmost spot on the deck, keeping watch, I suppose, as others, more dazed than anticipating what comes next, lean on the very side railings they've been crammed against. The long line of second-class passengers had squeezed into whatever place they can, taking their chances alongside hot boilers and disgruntled livestock, crowded, sweaty with the grime of the long dusty road on their way for the solemn north, as the Great Migration has long begun. A dozen men sit around a wooden crate, half of which most likely have been hired by the captain, standing tall by the bell with a cup of bourbon. The card swindlers, no doubt in my mind, shall split their takings with him, who, per his own will, looks the other way as bottles are passed as loosely as double-crossed dollar bills. Ignoring the raucous chorus of argument and boisterous laughter, I sit amongst the silent, taking deep breaths as time slows. The bank passes imperceptibly before my eyes, as fish splash amongst the seemingly motionless vessel. I hear the chirping of songbirds beyond the murmur and rumble as I watch the smooth glide of a red-tailed hawk against the sky. With old mist still to the east, 50 fellas off the boat, a deckhand shouts, "Captain's orders!" As luck may have it, we're stuck on a sandbank, and we've been told to get off and push. You, and y'all over there. Come on now, get off your ass. We'll come back round and pick y'all up 50 yards upshore. The fellows about me grumble and curse as we descend a ladder into the knee-high water. Along with the others, I give it my all, pushing a good 24 times to the deckhands count, until the boat breaks loose and makes its way out into the current, where the paddles slap free once more, turning the water to a froth and drudging slowly forth. Fellows trample through water and sand, bronzed and weather-beaten, a rather pathetic lot, myself amongst them, right where I belong. We help one another up the muddy bank and scurry 50 yards upstream to where the steamboat will circle back around. The fellows stand aghast as our luggage is tossed overboard, those whose wives and children are carried on. The fellows stand dumbfounded, jaws dropped, lips trembling, whose silence and desperation are soon shattered by furious hollers and kicking at the ground, and for some, giving fruitless chase through the cattail, while along with those giving it a swim to only be washed downriver, I wade out to sort through the bobbing luggage. I lug my suitcase back on dry land, as fellas continue to look about one another as though someone might offer an answer. But all anyone has to say is cursed, and in time, the sullen and shocked faces begin to drift off this way or that. Anywhere hope might dwell, anywhere but here. Off into the cypress, digested by shadow and lowland, fate utterly swallowing them whole as I plop down listless, right where uncertainty has left me. And happily alone, right here on my suitcase, out of sight, out of mind, along the merciless flow, the searing sunshine glistens off the rippling current before me. A slow wake licks the bank like a hound's tongue, and the breeze carries secrets all its own, foul of a few slight shades, past before a midday sun. Before me, the vast unknown wants to send me back toward my crowded, haunted thoughts, yet deep within, a stillness remains. The slow wake panting at my heels, like a loyal hound at my feet. I sit through the heat and wait for the day to sink like a stone, the flames of the sun no longer in sight, for those vast cosmos so effortlessly misunderstood to come into naked view, as I wish that only I could hear her heavenly voice once more. If only I could see her pecan eyes. If only she was here beside me, to feel but the cool breeze off the river on the nape of her neck, to lie down in the sand beside me in the night, as the reeds whisper ever so slight. The little nightbird in the trees, so brilliantly simple, with but a simple song to shine as bright as it might, as the crickets will soon measure the deadening of night. I sit through the night at the water's edge, feeding one book after the next to this mighty stream, and with the last, its pages, its words, and all its ghosts before me, I release to the delta, the gulf, and the sea, where I hope word, sound, and spirit might be set free. Word, sound, and spirit to sail vast seas, free of iron, following trade winds for calm water shored up by new lands, old soul swirling about, blowing with the wind through the magnolia, the willow, and cotton, shivering up bent over backs, thundering underfoot, dancing on unmarked graves, energy that ripens peaches and haunts vast mansions, wisping whispers in the night, blowing out bedside candlelight, lurking in voodoo parlors, spread wide in priests' eyes, cursing the wicked, blessing the meek, setting free countless many in life and death amongst the shadows and worms. Word, sound, and spirit filled cotton angels and stitched dolls, pale children on the lawns of sprawling estates, resting between the floorboards of dirty old shacks and under rocks and stones thrown in ponds, where the toads croak and the snakes slither, and within the tight grip of rage, and the clenched teeth of hate, and fingers that twirl grass in delight, and hissing whips, and the horse hooves trotting, and the bells and whistles, and gunpowder smoke, and shrieks and cries and bangs and laughs of madness, of joy and wisdom, and bewilderment, and chanting the cursed and cursing under the moonlight and in the midst of sunshine, in dark cellar, in bright white wide-open eyes, and fogged-over eyes alike, and in the deaf ears of those who can only hear with the bone, and in that of the walking, the swimming, and the drowning, and those who fall in the current which carries on. Word, sound, and spirit, paddling upstream, up the five fingers from the palm, spreading across new nations, bringing lore, bringing love, and tales of loss, songs to sing in smoky juke joints along highways, and jazz clubs with tablecloths down the street, sung and spoken on stage and spread vast and endless with radio waves, flickering screens and wobbling wax cylinders, and upon the placid page, between the lines, within a culture, before and after a beat, all through time, past and future, self-identify in the history of darkness and light, and the eternal battle that shall beat on in the heart of man, long after wars are lost and won. And in the end, what is left? As silence is the very word for the sound of spirit. The Bambulu's beat and Banza's wail can be heard far off Congo Square, where hundreds dance about the grassy commons. The Bambula, Kalinda, Congo, Carabine, and Juba, ornamented with Mikisi, tails of wild beasts, fringes, ribbons, little bells, and shells and balls, mingling and flirting about their arms and legs, dressed up like slaves. The males cover themselves in Oriental and Indian dress. The women are covered by only a sash of the same sort wrapped around their bodies. Clusters of tribal groupings each take their place in different parts of the square. The musicians play drums, gourds, and banjos, quill pipes made from reeds strung together like pan flutes, marimbas, and other European instruments such as the violin, tambourines, and triangles for the white spectators who have gathered on spread quilts about the vast lawn. Maids swatting flies away from arranged silver platters spread with sliced peaches, pimento cheese, squares of cornbread, and jars of fresh-squeezed lemonade, while true hoodoo rituals are more exotic, secret, and performed well out of sight. The hoodoo in Congo Square is predominantly a form of entertainment, and on a Sunday like this, a ring shout is performed to evoke ancestral spirits for assistance in healing in the light of day. The booming African drums and blast of massive wooden horns call the gathering for those far and wide. The drums are long, hollowed, and made of a single piece of wood, open at one end with goatskin stretched across the other. The small drums, bambula, are made from a joint or two of enormous bamboo, along with gourds, triangles, jaw harps, jaw bones, the grand instrument at last, the four-string banjo, and the bambula performing a bambula song, once said to be a frightful triumph of body over mind. About the grassy commons, sacred ground, ancient corn harvest, the lively three-beat rhythm cascades about the dancers and the gawkers on the lawn, as Negro women, a few of which most certainly ex-slaves, sew baskets of freshly made kalas, deep-fried cakes covered in powdered sugar to the ladies and gentlemen. As the day grows long, maids wrangle children and pack picnic bundles. A lady carries her crocheted umbrella to protect her pale skin from the warm western sun. The gentleman grabs a paper from a newsboy on the corner and reads the headline aloud. Lover found beaten dead in trunk. How terrible, says the lady. I tells you, ma'am, says one of the maids. World's going to hell in a handbasket, as the gentleman reads on. Northern drifter Oscar Clyde Olson, suspect in the murder of blues singer Nevaeh Little Bird Brown, has managed to elude capture. Before the morning of the murder, Olson was spotted staggering through the streets near his home. A local newsboy witnessed Olson just after sunrise. It is suspected that Olson had escaped his Storyville apartment after attacking her viciously in a blind rage when she refused his sexual advance, beating and killing Miss Brown. Then, with an unimaginable disdain for human dignity, Olson proceeded to stuff her in a trunk. Brown's husband, local businessman Silver Dollar Sam Carroyo, has issued a threat to Olson. If I ever get my hands on you, I'll chop you up into little pieces. I'll make you look like something that's been run through a sausage mill. This scum took my wife. She was beautiful. The city loved her. She was a success.